General instructions. You will have some time to read the questions before each task. Every recording will be played twice, with a short pause in between. You will have 30 seconds to revise your answers after the second time the recording is played. A single beep will mark the beginning of the complete listening comprehension exercise. A double beep will mark the end of the complete listening comprehension exercise. Task 1. Read the headings carefully and listen to the recordings. In block capitals, write the letter of the heading which goes with each recording in the space provided, as in example 0. There are two extra headings which do not match any of the recordings. Answers must be based exclusively on the information in the recording. Now you have some time to read the information below.
Example
0.
Well, I had my first of my four daughters. That's what happened. I was pregnant with Anae and I was, you know, getting ready as we all do when we're having our first baby with all the paraphernalia that you think you need. And I went out looking for these muslin blankets that were extremely common back home in Australia, so common that you could buy them in, you know, supermarkets. Mm. It was mind-blowing to me when I went looking for them in the US that they didn't actually exist.
You couldn't find them. And I guess just to explain to somebody who doesn't know what a muslin blanket is.
One.
Well, yeah, I mean, every available. I was up at 4 o'clock in the morning writing content and trying to work out kind of, okay, well, what is this thing that I want to do? But alongside that, running in parallel was I managed to find a place where I could teach meditation, just doing one-to-one at that point. I found a doctor who ran an integrative health centre in London where they had everything from sort of rheumatic specialists to cardiac specialists, you know, right across the board, all different disciplines. And he had heard of mindfulness and he said, well, look, if you can make it work here, then I'm happy to give you one of the clinic's rooms.
Two.
How you explained what the business model was at that time. Because just to clarify, Stitch Fix today, you sign up, you pay $20 a month, you get 5 items sent to you every month depending on your subscription. And if you buy them all, you get a discount. And if you return them all, that's fine. It's free, but it's $20 a month essentially for a personal stylist, right?
Yeah, and it's $20. And to be very clear, like you don't have to do it on a monthly basis. You could do it quarterly. You can do it a la carte. Like you don't, you know, you don't need to commit to any time frame. But it is every time you get a fix, you pay a $20 styling fee. The $20 is credit towards anything that you choose to buy.
Three.
Was the transition for you when you got there? Because you were, what, like 14 years old?
Yes, I've been living away from home since I was 13, 14 years old.
And were the first few months there hard for you?
Academically, yes. We get to the school and I realize I don't even have a computer. and, you know, all of my other classmates had computers, that sort of thing. And, yeah, I went to, I believe it was the English professor who was my advisor at the time. And I remember he took me to like this basement where all the used textbooks are. And then there was this old compact, like Presario computer that we had to like haul out and take it to my room.
Four.
Tony Hsieh, the guy who built this huge company with more than 1,000 employees, doesn't really like shoes. He's an 8 on the weird scale and an introvert. And yet, people who study companies and company culture come from all over the world to Zappos, to its headquarters in Las Vegas, to see how it operates. Because, as many of you know, at Zappos, there are no typical bosses. Employees have a lot of autonomy to make decisions. But at the same time, there's an obsessiveness about customer service. In fact, as you will hear, Zappos doesn't even think of itself as a shoe company.
5.
How much capital I really needed.
You walk away from that show without even a booth with $300,000 in orders. How are you going to finance that?
That was a big question right there. I didn't know what I didn't know. I wasn't part at that time, knowing all the things I know now. I wasn't part of the Chamber of Commerce. I didn't have any financial education. I didn't even have an accountant at the time. So I went to all the banks I could, and I got turned down by 27 of them.
You said, hey, I've got this business, and can I get a loan?
Yeah, I didn't know how to fill out a loan application. I didn't know how to.
6.
I mean, I knew in my heart and from all the feedback I'd gotten that people were excited about what I was doing. But I also, on the other hand, knew that there was going to be challenges. And that was I remember the day I got into the stores and I brought it after making those 500 bars by hand. And I remember standing there and I was excited, exhilarated, anxious, scared to death. I mean, it was like putting a piece of art on display.
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, like, what explains why it sold so well? Like, now you think about.
7.
And it was at a time, it was just a really hard time in media, period, in New York. So this was 2008. There was lots of layoffs happening. The beginning of the internet as a, like, disintermediation of publishers was happening. So if you were in legacy media, you were looking around, realizing that your business model was collapsing,
yeah,
and people were beginning to get laid off from, like, newspapers, and there was this rise of digital. And I remember reading an article in New York Magazine about how, like, media was no longer going to run New York.
0.
Well, I had my first of my 4 daughters. That's what happened. I was pregnant with Anae and I was, you know, getting ready as we all do when we're having our first baby with all the paraphernalia that you think you need. And I went out looking for these muslin blankets that were extremely common back home in Australia, so common that you could buy them in, you know, supermarkets. It was mind-blowing to me when I went looking for them in the US that they didn't actually exist.
You couldn't find them. And I guess just to explain to somebody who doesn't know what a muslin blanket is.
1.
Yeah, I mean, every available. I was up at 4 o'clock in the morning writing content and trying to work out kind of, okay, well, what is this thing that I want to do? But alongside that, running in parallel, was I managed to find a place where I could teach meditation, just doing one-to-one at that point. I found a doctor who ran an integrative health centre in London where they had everything from sort of rheumatic specialists to cardiac specialists, you know, right across the board, all different disciplines. And he had heard of mindfulness and he said, well, look, if you can make it work here, then I'm happy to give you one of the clinic's rooms.
2.
How you explained what the business model was at that time. Because just to clarify, Stitch Fix today, you sign up, You pay $20 a month. You get 5 items sent to you every month, depending on your subscription. And if you buy them all, you get a discount. And if you return them all, that's fine. It's free, but it's $20 a month, essentially for a personal stylist, right?
Yeah, and it's $20. And to be very clear, like, you don't have to do it on a monthly basis. You could do it quarterly. You can do it a la carte. Like, you don't, you know, you don't need to commit to any right. time frame. But it is, every time you get a fix, you pay a $20 styling fee. The $20 is credit towards anything that you choose to buy.
3.
Was the transition for you when you got there? Because you were, what, like 14 years old?
Yes, I've been living away from home since I was 13, 14 years old.
And
yes.
Were the first few months there hard for you?
Academically, yes. We get to the school and I realize I don't even have a computer. and, you know, all of my other classmates had computers, that sort of thing. And, you know, I went to, I believe it was the English professor who was my advisor at the time. And I remember he took me to like this basement where all the used textbooks are. And then there was this old compact, like Presario computer that we had to like haul out and take it to my room.
4.
Tony Hsieh, the guy who built this huge company with more than 1,000 employees, doesn't really like shoes. He's an 8 on the weird scale and an introvert. And yet, people who study companies and company culture come from all over the world to Zappos, to its headquarters in Las Vegas, to see how it operates. Because, as many of you know, at Zappos, there are no typical bosses. Employees have a lot of autonomy to make decisions. But at the same time, there's an obsessiveness about customer service. In fact, as you will hear, Zappos doesn't even think of itself as a shoe company.
5.
How much capital I really needed.
You walk away from that show without even a booth with $300,000 in orders. How are you going to finance that?
That was a big question right there. I didn't know what I didn't know. I wasn't part at that time, knowing all the things I know now. I wasn't part of the Chamber of Commerce. I didn't have any financial education. I didn't even have an accountant at the time. So I went to all the banks I could, and I got turned down by 27 of them.
You said, hey, I've got this business, and can I get a loan?
Yeah, I didn't know how to fill out a loan application. I didn't know how to...
6.
I mean, I knew in my heart, and from all the feedback I'd gotten, that people were excited about what I was doing. But I also, on the other hand, knew that there was going to be challenges, and that was the... I remember the day I got into the stores and I brought it after making those 500 bars by hand. And I remember standing there and I was excited, exhilarated, anxious, scared to death. I mean, it was like putting a piece of art on display.
Yeah. What do you think, I mean, like, what explains why it sold so well? Like, now you think about...
7.
And it was at a time, it was just a really hard time in media period in New York. So this was 2008. There was lots of layoffs happening. The beginning of the internet as a like disintermediation of publishers was happening. So if you were in legacy media, you were looking around realizing that your business model was collapsing.
Yeah.
And people were beginning to get laid off from like newspapers. And there was this rise of digital. And I remember reading an article in New York Magazine about how, like, media was no longer going to run New York.
2. Read the notes below and listen carefully to the recording in the spaces provided in block capitals. Complete the information required with no more than 4 words. Gap 0 is given as an example. answers must be based exclusively on the information in the recording. Now you have some time to read the information below.
Centuries ago, poor children scraped a living from the mud along London's River Thames, scavenging among the bones and trash that washed down from the city. They were called mudlarks, and their work was dirty and dangerous. Today, people still pick things out of the river mud, but now they're looking for bits of the city's history. Writer Laura Maklum is one of these modern-day mudlarks and has written a book called, you guessed it, Mudlark. NPR's Petra Mayer met up with her on the banks of the Thames.
On the north side of the river, between a pub and a railway bridge, there's a rickety metal staircase down to another world. Or rather, several worlds, layered on top of each other and jumbled together in the slightly stinky river mud.
What are these round glass
things? It's supposed to be an old Victorian beer bottle.
It's a bright, blowy day. Seagulls are wheeling overhead, barges pass by in the background, and everywhere I look, there are little fragments of history. Laura Maklum is an able guide to all this history. She's been mudlarking for more than 15 years, and her book is a detailed tour of both the Thames and the treasures you can find there, like this mysterious brown thing that I've just dug out of the mud.
This looks like a piece of pottery here.
That could be Roman. It hasn't got any glaze on it, and it's got some quite large inclusions in it. So it could be a piece of Roman pottery. Well done.
Huh. Yay! Yay me!
We're basically walking on a giant garbage dump, Maklum says. Shattered pottery, chunks of Roman heating duct, roof tile scarred by the Great Fire of London, glass bottles and clay pipes, and so many bones, the relics of centuries of dinners. These objects tell everyday stories about lives that don't end up in the history books.
I'm finding these ordinary pieces that perhaps, almost undoubtedly, nobody's touched since the last person who dropped it. Even the prehistoric flints, you know, the last person who touched that was the person who was maybe, you know, throwing a spear at some animal that doesn't even exist anymore. And to reach down and pick that up is like reaching back through time into history itself. And it's the closest thing I can imagine to time travel.
And I should point out here that not everyone can just climb down onto the foreshore and start time traveling. You have to have an official permit, which Maklum does. And she says some of her very favorite ordinary objects to find are pins.
So if you look down here very carefully, I can see one there.
I would never have spotted that.
So this is handmade. They date from 1400 to about 1800. The pinning industry in this country was huge, so huge that they actually imported pins from France as well, because everybody was pinned into their clothes. So those elaborate ruffs that you see Elizabeth I wearing took hundreds of pins to put together. But they dropped and lost a lot because they were wearing a lot, and they washed together in certain areas. So if you can find a patch.
I think I see one right
with
here.
Pins. Have you
is
got
that,
one?
Is that one by my toe?
Just there?
Yeah.
Yeah, just there.
I feel like you've had to become a historian to understand all the things that you find out here.
I suppose so. I mean, I'm not an archaeologist and I'm not a historian. I'd never pretend to be one. I'm a history seeker, I suppose. And it spurs you into researching when you find these things.
Maklum does work with historians. She has a Facebook page where she posts her finds, and a community has grown up around it, dedicated to puzzling them out. She's also taken pieces to university history departments and museums, and she says it's really important to report what you find. The UK has a program called the Portable Antiquities Scheme that documents the treasures found by metal detectors and mudlarks.
This is our history, it's our heritage. Take it home and stick it in a drawer and forget about it is criminal, I think.
At the end of the afternoon, Makelam spreads out our finds on a convenient riverside rock, arranging them chronologically from a Roman mosaic tile to a 17th century clay pipe to a shard of blue and white Victorian pottery, a miniature history of England picked from the river mud.
Now, listen again.
Centuries ago, poor children scraped a living from the mud along London's River Thames, scavenging among the bones and trash that washed down from the city. They were called mudlarks, and their work was dirty and dangerous. Today, people still pick things out of the river mud, but now they're looking for bits of the city's history. Writer Laura Makelam is one of these modern-day mudlarks and has written a book called, you guessed it, Mudlark. NPR's Petra Mayer met up with her on the banks of the Thames.
On the north side of the river, between a pub and a railway bridge, there's a rickety metal staircase down to another world. Or rather, several worlds, layered on top of each other and jumbled together in the slightly stinky river mud.
What are these round glass
things? It's the bottom of an old Victorian beer bottle.
It's a bright, blowy day. Seagulls are wheeling overhead, barges pass by in the background, and everywhere I look, there are little fragments of history. Laura Makelam is an able guide to all this history. She's been mudlarking for more than 15 years, and her book is a detailed tour of both the Thames and the treasures you can find there, like this mysterious brown thing that I've just dug out of the mud.
This looks like a piece of pottery here.
That could be Roman. It hasn't got any glaze on it, and it's got some quite large inclusions in it. So it could be a piece of Roman pottery. Well done.
Huh. Yay! Yay me!
We're basically walking on a giant garbage dump, Makelam says. Shattered pottery, chunks of Roman heating duct, roof tile scarred by the Great Fire of London, glass bottles and clay pipes, and so many bones, the relics of centuries of dinners. These objects tell everyday stories about lives that don't end up in the history books.
I'm finding these ordinary pieces that perhaps, almost undoubtedly, nobody's touched since the last person who dropped it. Even the prehistoric flints, you know, the last person who touched that was the person who was maybe, you know, throwing a spear at some animal that doesn't even exist anymore. And to reach down and pick that up is like reaching back through time into history itself. And it's the closest thing I can imagine to time travel.
And I should point out here that not everyone can just climb down onto the foreshore and start time traveling. You have to have an official permit, which Makelam does. And she says some of her very favorite ordinary objects to find are pins.
So if you look down here very carefully, I can see one there.
I would never have spotted that.
So this is handmade. They date from 1400 to about 1800. The pinning industry in this country was huge, so huge that they actually imported pins from France as well, because everybody was pinned into their clothes. So those elaborate ruffs that you see Elizabeth I wearing took hundreds of pins to put together. But they dropped and lost a lot because they were wearing a lot, and they washed together in certain areas. So if you could find a patch.
I think I see one right
here.
Pins.
Have you got
one? Is that one by my toe?
Just there?
Yeah.
Yeah, just there.
I feel like you've had to become a historian to understand all the things that you find out here.
I suppose so. I mean, I'm not an archaeologist and I'm not a historian. I'd never pretend to be one. I'm a history seeker, I suppose. And it spurs you into researching when you find these things.
Makelam does work with historians. She has a Facebook page where she posts her finds, and a community has grown up around it, dedicated to puzzling them out. She's also taken pieces to university history departments and museums, and she says it's really important to report what you find. The UK has a program called the Portable Antiquities Scheme that documents the treasures found by metal detectors and mudlarks.
This is our history, it's our heritage. Take it home, stick it in a drawer, and forget about it is criminal, I think.
At the end of the afternoon, Makelam spreads out our finds on a convenient riverside rock, arranging them chronologically from a Roman mosaic tile to a 17th century clay pipe to a shard of blue and white Victorian pottery. A miniature history of England picked from the river mud.
Task 3. Read the statements carefully and listen to the recording. Choose the option A, B, or C that best completes each statement. Mark the correct option in the space provided, as in example 0. Only one option is correct. Answers must be based exclusively on the information in the recording. Now you have some time to read the information below.
This month, Los Angeles passed a new ordinance restricting the use of plastic straws. Restaurants can't offer them unless a customer requests one. All this means more demand for paper straws, which is good news for an Indiana-based company called Aardvark Straws. Joining us is Andy Romju, who's the president. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And give us a sense of how the demand for paper straws has been growing since you acquired Aardvark Paper Straw Company.
Well, it's truly been astronomical. Aardvark is a company had over the last 3 or 4 years been doubling sales each year. And as we have gone through with all of the different cities banning straws, as well as some of the eco and advocate groups really pushing for change in the environment, and really pretty much everybody is looking to make a shift away from plastic straws.
And at the time you acquired Aardvark, it was the only company in the country making paper straws. Is it still the only one?
We know there's a couple of other companies that have jumped in, and anytime you get a market that's really booming like this one is, that's to be expected. But where Aardvark is different is, number one, we've got a little bit of a head start, and number two, we've got a really big head start on making the highest quality and longest lasting paper straw out in the market.
And what about international demand? Are there other big companies around the world that are doing the same thing?
Absolutely. Europe is looking to go single-use plastic-free over the next couple of years, and obviously straws fit into that category, so there's some big demand coming there. Australia is looking at some legislation, so yes, this isn't just a U.S. thing. It's truly global.
Tell us about the new factory that you had to build here in this country to keep up with demand.
Yeah, so we stayed in Fort Wayne. That's where the expertise and where all the folks were that really knew how to make this Aardvark straw. So we realized day one as we moved into the business that we needed to either be able to expand the factory that we were in or be able to find something that was nearby. We ended up finding something that was nearby that was about three times the size of the existing factory and had it remodeled and refurbished to exactly what we need to provide these high-quality straws.
Well, do you employ a lot of people to do this, or is it mostly machines that are making the straws?
No, there's definitely a ton of human capital involved, and there's an art to winding straws. It's you can take a machine, but you still have to have a person that's really talented to run that machine. We've hired well over 100 folks in Fort Wayne already, and we'll most likely have to double that number by the time we get to our expected run rate.
Now, the big question that I've heard about paper straws is that, yes, they are biodegradable and compostable. That means they are made to disintegrate. So how do you make sure that they don't disintegrate in the drinks?
That is the key. So straws and how they hold up is really a function of a few things. It's the type of paper you're using, how many layers of paper you're using, the adhesive that holds it together, and then the coating that goes around it. So you have to get the right mix of all those different types of things that allow it to last as long as possible, but then also the ability that it'll start breaking down when it gets into the oceans or waterways or into your compost or trash.
And do you think that you've reached the right level of sort of ability to hold up in liquid that you need, or you think that it needs to get better?
We always want to get better. I think Aardvark, and the reason we were interested in Aardvark is they made the strongest straw in the world, but you'll still have people that say that, and you know, it'll last as long as your drink will last. You can put it in most liquids and it'll last well over an hour. There's folks that leave their straws in there for longer. There's people that, you know, use it differently. They want to stir, they want to do things that that help it break down faster. So we're already in development of what we call straw 2.0. So what is the next generation of straw? You know, how can we change and play with those components that I mentioned to get something that lasts 2, 3, 4 times longer than existing and holds up under even more extreme, you know, temperatures and usages.
What do you think of some of the backlash? I've seen some news reports where, you know, people are making fun of this idea that you would not use a plastic straw, that it's some kind of, you know, environmental activist movement that shouldn't be taken seriously.
We've had a lot of conversations with a lot of the groups that have been pushing it, and really what the war is against is single-use plastics. Straws became the focal point because of really two things. Number one, you could definitely do without in most cases. And number two, there was a viable alternative in the paper straw to offer a solution.
What's the difference in price right now between the plastic straw and the paper straw?
Right now, a paper straw would be 3 to 4 times the same cost as a plastic straw. But it, you know, in the United States, it's a $1 billion market or so. When you double, triple, quadruple that, those are still real dollars that are flowing through. We think a lot of that will go away as people present straws upon demand or upon request. So you see a 30% to 40% decrease in straw usage overall. If they do need one, we hope they're using the Aardvark paper straw.
Now, listen again.
This month, Los Angeles passed a new ordinance restricting the use of plastic straws. Restaurants can't offer them unless a customer requests one. All this means more demand for paper straws, which is good news for an Indiana-based company called Aardvark Straws. Joining us is Andy Romju, who's the president. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And give us a sense of how the demand for paper straws has been growing since you acquired Aardvark Paper Straw Company.
Well, it's truly been astronomical. Aardvark is a company had, over the last 3 or 4 years, been doubling sales each year. And as we have gone through with all of the different cities banning straws, as well as some of the eco and advocate groups really pushing for change in the environment, and really pretty much everybody is looking to make a shift away from plastic straws.
And at the time you acquired Aardvark, it was the only company in the country making paper straws. Is it still the only one?
We know there's a couple of other companies that have jumped in, and anytime you get a market that's really booming like this one is, that's to be expected. But where Aardvark is different is, number one, we've got a little bit of a head start, and number two, we've got a really big head start on making the highest quality and longest lasting paper straw out in the market.
And what about international demand? Are there other big companies around the world that are doing the same thing?
Absolutely. Europe is looking to go single-use plastic-free over the next couple of years, and obviously straws fit into that category, so there's some big demand coming there. Australia is looking at some legislation, so yes, this isn't just a U.S. thing. It's truly global.
Tell us about the new factory that you had to build here in this country to keep up with demand.
Yeah, so we stayed in Fort Wayne. That's where the expertise and where all the folks were that really knew how to make this Aardvark straw. So we realized day one as we moved into the business that we needed to either be able to expand the factory that we were in or be able to find something that was nearby. We ended up finding something that was nearby that was about three times the size of the existing factory and had it remodeled and refurbished to exactly what we need to provide these high quality straws.
Well, do you employ a lot of people to do this, or is it mostly machines that are making the straws?
No, there's definitely a ton of human capital involved, and there's an art to winding straws. It's you can take a machine, but you still have to have a person that's really talented to run that machine. We've hired well over 100 folks in Fort Wayne already, and we'll most likely have to double that number by the time we get to our expected run rate.
Now, the big question that I've heard about paper straws is that, yes, they are biodegradable and compostable. That means they are made to disintegrate. So how do you make sure that they don't disintegrate in the drinks?
That is the key. So straws and how they hold up is really a function of a few things. It's the type of paper you're using, how many layers of paper you're using, the adhesive that holds it together, and then the coating that goes around it. So you have to get the right mix of all those different types of things that allow it to last as long as possible, but then also the ability that it'll start breaking down when it gets into the oceans or waterways or into your compost or trash.
And do you think that you've reached the right level of sort of ability to hold up in liquid that you need, or you think that it needs to get better?
We always want to get better. I think Aardvark, and the reason we were interested in Aardvark is they made the strongest straw in the world, but you'll still have people that say that, it'll last as long as your drink will last. You can put it in most liquids and it'll last well over an hour. There's folks that leave their straws in there for longer. There's people that use it differently. They want to stir. They want to do things that help it break down faster. So we're already in development of what we call straw 2.0. So what is the next generation of straw? How can we change and play with those components that I mentioned to get something that lasts 2, 3, 4 times longer than existing and holds up under even more extreme temperatures and usages.
What do you think of some of the backlash? I've seen some news reports where, people are making fun of this idea that you would not use a plastic straw, that it's some kind of, environmental activist movement that shouldn't be taken seriously.
We've had a lot of conversations with a lot of the groups that have been pushing it, and really what the war is against is single-use plastics. Straws became the focal point because of really two things. Number one, you could definitely do without in most cases. And number two, there was a viable alternative in the paper straw to offer a solution.
What's the difference in price right now between the plastic straw and the paper straw?
Right now, a paper straw would be 3 to 4 times the same cost as a plastic straw. But it, in the United States, it's a $1 billion market or so. When you double, triple, quadruple that, those are still real dollars that are flowing through. We think a lot of that will go away as people present straws upon demand or upon request. So you see a 30% to 40% decrease in straw usage overall. If they do need one, we hope they're using the Aardvark paper straw.
This is the end of the complete listening comprehension test.